Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Aleut, an Alaska Native regional corporation serving over 5,000 Unangak shareholders and descendants with a mission to provide economic growth. Aleut's portfolio includes government contracting, real estate, technology, and energy. Learn more at aleutcorp.com.
Immigrants from countries across the world come to America seeking opportunity, freedom from political, religious, or cultural persecution, and a better future for their children. For hundreds of years, immigrants helped build the infrastructure that is our nation's economic backbone and were welcomed here. But currently, the Trump administration is actively removing or threatening to remove even legal immigrants out of our country and state, causing confusion and fear. We'll discuss what's known about who is being targeted and what the legal response is today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Most of us are immigrants or descended from immigrants. Only the indigenous people of North America can claim original inhabitant status. For the rest of us, whether it's been one, three, or five generations since arrival, our families have come from other countries all over the world. Once arriving in the country, people migrate to other states for work, education, culture, and community. Alaska is an amazingly diverse state, boasting some of the most diverse zip codes and high schools in the nation. But misinformation on social media and from the current president has stoked fears about immigrants coming to our country and state. Alaska depends on foreign-born workers for seasonal employment, and the diversity of our state has been a strength, not a vulnerability. So how did we go from a country welcoming immigrants with the Statue of Liberty's statement of, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free," to snatching people from campuses, from citizenship appointments, and from work sites, deporting them or sending them to foreign prisons, many with abhorrent conditions? It's a question our guests today are grappling with. Issa Spatrisano is the Refugee Program Coordinator for Catholic Social Services. Nicholas Olano is an immigration attorney with Nations Law Group based in Anchorage. And Cindy Woods is the Senior Immigration Law and Policy Fellow for the ACLU of Alaska. All are in the studio today, which is awesome. Welcome, all three of you.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for being here. To start us all off, for all of you, help us understand the different ways that people come to our country and state. There are paths to legal immigration. There's something called humanitarian parole, asylum, refugee status, various visas for education, work, or visiting. Help us understand the different types of applicants. Who wants to start us off there?
Should we start with refugees? Because that's a legal way to come in, and Issa is kind of the expert in that.
Yeah, I can talk about the populations that we are able to serve.
Right.
The refugee program here in Alaska has been in existence for over 20 years, but the refugee program in the United States is over 40 years old, and there are a number of individuals who can be served through the refugee program. We call them Office of Refugee Resettlement Eligible Populations, which is way too long, which is why we often just say refugees. But it encompasses more than just refugees. Refugees are individuals who flee persecution based on a number of factors, who are displaced outside of their own country and come through what's called the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. And so refugees come here legally. The day they arrive, they can work. They're on a pathway to citizenship. They can adjust their status to green cards after 1 year to lawful permanent residency. And so refugees are one specific category. We often tend to think about refugees similar to asylees. Refugees are processed overseas. They complete that process overseas. So the day they arrive, they're ready to go because they did all that processing overseas. Asylees are a little bit different. They enter the country somehow, could be here on a student visa or some other form. Something occurs in their country. It's not safe for them to return home. They may avail themselves to CBP at the border and say, I need to enter. It's unsafe for me to remain in my home country. They come in and they do that processing here inside the borders of our country. But very similarly, they're fleeing persecution on the basis of race, national origin, you know, preferred membership in a particular social group. And so those populations, again, if you get asylum, you're on a pathway to citizenship. So those individuals are served by our office and other people we contract with to provide employment case management services and other things. We're also able to serve a couple other small populations, foreign-born victims of trafficking who have specific visas, Cuban Haitian entrants, they're called. And then also in recent years, individuals with humanitarian parole, specifically from two countries, Ukraine and Afghanistan. And that's a little bit different, way different than refugees and asylees, because they're really here on a very temporary program, which is very different than refugees and asylees who are on a permanent pathway to citizenship. That's not the case for our individuals on humanitarian parole. So that's a recent change in the last few years, and that authority was granted by Congress to serve those individuals. Some of them can adjust their statuses, like Afghans. Many of our Afghans have adjusted their status to lawful permanent resident or have received asylum since arriving. But our Ukrainians are kind of stuck waiting. There's not really a path forward for them. So immigration is complicated, and I'm only serving a small group of people. So my friends over here are legal, who are attorneys. They would know more about all the other populations.
And what are the most common paths for people who make their way to Alaska? Who is coming here under what status predominantly?
I would say family-based petitioners are the largest. We have people from the Philippines bringing their family members. We have people from all different countries here that have come, including as refugees who became citizens petitioning for family members. I would say that that is the largest number of incoming immigrants to Alaska at this time.
Okay. For people who cross illegally, can they try to get on a track to legal status, or are they mostly deported if they haven't tried to come in the country through a legal pathway?
So we were talking just now before we started the show about something called the notice to appear in the NTA.
Yes.
That's the beginning of deportation or removal proceedings. When somebody shows up at the border, particularly now this happened during the Biden administration, and expresses a fear of going back to their country, they're placed in removal proceedings in order to ask for asylum. Asylum is exactly the same thing as a refugee, but stateside. They're asking for the same benefit, just that benefit in the refugee's case, as Issa said, was granted overseas, and they came in with that documentation. Now they're going to go either one of two ways. Let's say that person came to the border, was not stopped by immigration, kept going, and that within a year of arriving, that person asks for asylum. That's one way to go. Other way to go is the person arrives at the border, like we had with the Biden administration, and they express to CBP the fear of returning, and then they're going to be placed in removal proceedings for the purpose of asking for asylum. Now, the person who came in before, asked for asylum before USCIS, if they get denied, they will get referred to the immigration judge. And that is the whole process in which people can also ask for asylum here, either of those two ways.
I remember during Madeline, our producer, did, of course, terrific pre-interviews with all three of you. And I don't remember if it was you, Issa, or who said that oftentimes refugees are in transit, sort of in limbo for years and years. Was it 17 years?
Yeah, the average refugee waits overseas for resettlement. So from the time they flee from their home into a secondary displacement, into a secondary country, the average wait times for resettlement is 17 years. And so I think a good point to what Nick is saying that I think is often missed is that everyone assumes that coming to a border is illegal. It's not illegal to come to a border. In fact, that's the legal way to come to a country and say, I have a reasonable fear of persecution. I can no longer reside in my country. Now imagine you're an individual who is in that situation. We didn't used to do refugee processing in South America or Latin America in the Southern Hemisphere. So there was no other option for people other than to come to the southern border. I mean, that's how it was designed, and it's legal to come and say, I have a reasonable fear of persecution. I want to seek asylum. And so, you know, for people who are in that situation in the Southern Hemisphere, what other choice did they have? And if you're a refugee in Africa, yeah, you wait 17 years to come here. And that's if you ever get to come. There's 38 million refugees. You have less than 1% chance of ever being resettled. So I think there's an inherent misunderstanding. And when I speak in the community, I feel like so often it's like, if someone comes to our border, they did it illegally. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. That's not true. Of course, there are people who may illegally come across the border, right? But it's legal to avail yourself at the border and say it's unsafe for me to return home. And so I think that there's been a lot of misunderstanding around that. And I just feel like I constantly am clearing that up. But yeah, refugees and asylees, they're very similar, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The way to flee violence in the Southern Hemisphere is to seek asylum in the United States. And people have the right to do that.
Yep.
And Nick, turning back to you, I think some people, and Cindy, I'd love for you to pick it up here too, would say that what is happening currently related to immigrants and refugees, asylum seekers, is unprecedented. But you said we've been here before. Tell us what you are talking about, what you're referencing.
What happened after 9/11 with the reaction that we had towards immigration. We had a complete change of our immigration system back there in 2001. And I think that it was designed as an administrative system to easily detain people and process people with less due process than in a criminal setting. Why? Because I think they were targeting 9/11 individuals, terrorists, and it would give an opportunity for the government to detain people under a scheme that really has less procedural safeguards than, say, a regular arrest. Why were we here before? Because during the Bush era and part of the Obama era, we did have a significant amount of enforcement. I think we're at the same levels or a little bit more of enforcement right now. But as far as enforcement goes, we've been there before. What has changed is the messaging and the context. We were fighting maybe a terrorist and we're clearly well-supported to be afraid of what happened after 9/11. Right now, it's just almost a racist messaging from the administration is what I feel is coming in regards to immigration. So we're having enforcement for a different reason in a different context. Now you see USCIS and ICE posting pictures of individuals that they've detained and making propaganda out of it. And the word is propaganda. That I think is that's what's changed.
Cindy, your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, I think I worked previously on the border for around 5 years, and there has been an unprecedented change in the number and types of people that are coming to the southern border to seek protection. I think back in the early 80s and 90s, the majority were from the Northern Triangle regions of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. But, after the pandemic, we saw a huge amount of individuals from other countries as well, not even just the Southern Hemisphere, finding their way to the southern border to try and seek asylum at the border. And along those lines, we also saw with the Biden administration and the former Trump administration attempts to make it illegal to seek asylum at the border. So we had the Securing the Border Act in 2024 that made it illegal to come to the border and seek asylum if you'd come through another country first. A lot of different policies were put into place to try to make it unlawful and to punish people who did try to avail themselves of U.S. territory to seek protection. And so we've seen this huge wave of folks coming to the southern border. The Biden administration did a lot of creative policies to try to process those folks in the southern hemisphere, to try to create a process for folks to come in with appointments through CBP. And now the Trump administration is trying to walk that back and claim that those folks are here illegally when they were authorized to enter under the previous administration's policies.
And the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program was shut down on January 20th. Is that correct?
Yeah. So there was an executive order called Realigning the United States Refugee Admissions Program, and it effectively closed it until further notice and has yet to be reopened by the administration.
How does that affect people in Alaska?
Well, it immediately affected 22 individuals who had flights booked who should have arrived and whose flights were canceled as a result of that executive order. And so those were people's family members. One member of the community who spoke out, her sister was supposed to arrive, who was 7 months pregnant, and her flight got canceled. She had already departed the refugee camp. She was ready to come here. She had given away all of her clothes, all of her resources, everything, and then was told, your flight's not leaving, go back to the camp. I mean, these are real people's lives. There was 12,000 people booked to come to the United States and who all had their flights canceled. And so those people are still in limbo. And since many other things have occurred in the meantime, but one of the things being that the State Department has terminated all contracts with all the national resettlement agencies that resettle people. So there is effectively no refugee admissions program right now. And there was supposed to be within 90 days a report from the administration outlining sort of what the plan was be, and that has not been released yet. So we're kind of in limbo to try to understand what's happening. And as frustrating as that may be for me as the state refugee coordinator, that has no candle at all to the fact that there are people whose families are waiting, and those are real people who thought they were coming, who are some of them at airports. On their way to come to the United States.
And when you say that those programs were canceled by the United States, What does that mean in the countries where people are staging and trying to get in? Does that mean that there's just like nobody home to process anything and they're just sort of stuck there? And then the country that they're waiting in has to try to figure out how to either help them settle there or go somewhere else?
People are in secondary countries right now, in refugee camps or in urban centers, living the lives that they've been living for the last 16, 17 years, and they continue to be in limbo and wait and pen to see, are they ultimately going to be able to arrive? Is the program going to reopen? What will it look like when it reopens? The State Department said that they are starting to restart processing, but if you restart processing and you still have no way to get in, I don't know how effective processing is. There is no way for people to come right now. There is no active resettlement program. And unfortunately, the refugee resettlement program is the probably the most heavily vetted group of people who enter the United States. Refugees go through extreme vetting that takes anywhere from 6 months to 18 months to do. And there are certain stages of that that if they expire, like your medical, you must redo it. And so medical screenings are only good for 6 months. And so you have a number of people who are going to require all new medical screenings, all new vetting. That person who was supposed to come to Alaska, who didn't arrive, who's 7 months pregnant, has now had a child. That child needs to be screened and added to the case. And that's all going to take time. She may not come for three more years because that child was born and she wasn't able to enter. So it's not as simple as like you just turn the water back on and there it is. You got to rebuild all the pipes. And so, like, people keep saying, well, when it restarts, it'll restart. I keep hearing, like, getting that question. It's not that simple. It may restart, and we may not see an arrival for 4, 5, 6 months through the traditional program. And we don't even know what the administration's going to do at this point.
Just standing the whole system up will take time. And if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. Today, we're talking about immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers who are in Alaska, and what we all need to know about their legal status and what folks who have questions need to know about where they can find answers to those questions. In the studio with me today is Issa Spatrisano. Issa is the refugee coordinator for Catholic Social Services. Also with us is Nicholas Olano. Nick is an immigration attorney for Nations Law Group here in Anchorage. And Cindy Woods is the Senior Immigration Law and Policy Fellow for the ACLU of Alaska. So, Issa, I wanted to ask about, if I can find my question again, humanitarian parole for Cuban, Haitian people here. Describe what that status is, how many people in Alaska have it, and what is happening currently after their status was removed.
So here in Alaska, and I won't have exact numbers because I, of course, only have the numbers of people who opt to enroll in the program. So our program is optional. People may be here residing in the state of Alaska and for some reason chosen not to enroll in refugee benefits and services. So there was about 30 individuals who were enrolled in services, receiving services from our program who are eligible, who are Cubans and Haitians, who were in that first 5 years of arrival. Of course, the administration has tried to roll back. It's kind of what Cindy had said, right? People came here legally through a process that was set up under the Biden administration called the Cuban, Haitian, Nicaraguan, Venezuelan program. And that has been revoked. And they were told that they all had to leave within 30 days. It's entered into litigation, so it's not that simple, exactly what's happening now. And many of our community members who came through that group that we were serving, many of them have chosen to self-deport at this point. I think there's just concern about ultimately, and I think you alluded to it in the beginning, like if I get picked up and I get deported and I ultimately end up in an El Salvadorian prison, perhaps I'm better off choosing a different route. Maybe I know family or friends in another location or in another country or have another option. And many people are looking at what are all bad options, to be honest, because they were here legally in a program where they were made a promise that they could stay for a certain period of time and they had laid down the roots and they were all working, you know, in our economy, helping our state. And so some of them have chosen to self-deport because there's some at least control in that and power and ability to manage your own life and protect your children. And that's a loss for all of us and for our state. And so, yeah, things can end in litigation and we can say, well, they don't have to go. But if you were in their shoes, what would you do? You know, and so it's just been a challenge. And that's what these policies are doing. They're leaving people with no options. They're leaving people stranded and having to be forced to make an implausible decision that for some of them in-
includes self-deportation.
Are Ukrainian people on similar status here?
Yes. And they're waiting to see what the administration may do with their status. And again, I mean, I don't know how many Ukrainians I have spoken to that we serve who have bought land and are ready to buy houses, who were enrolled at UAA and questioning if they should go. I mean, people are at a loss of what to do. If you are uncertain about your future, are you going to invest time, resources, and energy to stay? Probably not. And you know who that hurts? All of us. All of us who are sitting in this room who are Alaskans, because those are individuals who want to be here, who are buying homes, whose kids are graduating from our high schools like this weekend, heading off to UAA to help build our state's economy. They fill essential roles on the pipeline. They do jobs across this whole state that we need. And we just got a bill through the Alaska legislature to allow Ukrainians to get CDLs. And what I know of a handful of them who are now CDL drivers that our state desperately needs. And are you going to go pursue that training and that certification now if you think you're going to get deported or told you can't stay? I mean, this hurts all of us. I just want to say that. I mean, for actual people and the fear they're having to live through, and we only talk about that, I think as a state we all need to realize this is hurting all of us.
Cindy, I want you to pick it up there because you had talked in an earlier interview about many people who are here legally but are still afraid. What are they saying about this?
Yeah, so, you know, I think Issa put it beautifully. Our state depends on the power of immigrants, you know, $2 billion in spending power of foreign-born Alaskans. You know, the ACLU has been doing has been trying to educate the community around their rights. And the most important message that we have is that, you know, all individuals, all Alaskans, whether or not they're citizens, have fundamental rights. They have civil liberties, constitutional rights. And so understanding what those rights are, I think there have been a number of individuals that I've spoken to who are here legally or who are in removal proceedings that have received a letter from the government saying, your status expires in 7 days and you need to leave. Though a lot of those individuals are in removal proceedings, and if they left, that would have horrible consequences for their ability to return. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of questions, a lot of hypotheticals are posed to us in our Know Your Rights presentations because there's so many rumors and so many policies that are being announced and then litigated and then paused. And so there's just a huge amount of uncertainty on the next steps and what to do. And here in Alaska, there's also a huge gap in access to immigration attorneys. You know, Nick and his firm notwithstanding, there's, you know, very few immigration attorneys here in the state and a huge need for individual consultations that even lawful immigrants have questions on and how they could be impacted. And so that's one thing that we're also trying to work on is to close that access to justice gap and provide more general information and also opportunities for direct consultation with attorneys to understand what those options are, because unfortunately it is a real consideration that even folks with legal status need to make. You know, do I self-deport? What are my protections? What might happen if I'm picked up and placed in proceedings?
Well, and I want you to drill down a little bit there, and then Nick, I'd like for you to pick it up about constitutional rights. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would not expect that non-citizens of this country would have any rights under the U.S. Constitution, but of course they do. Mm-hmm. Talk about what people should know about those rights if they get detained.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's really the point, is that non-citizens have constitutional rights and those apply as well. If you are detained by immigration enforcement officials, you have the right to request an attorney. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And it's a scary time when you see on the news, you know, individuals being picked up off the street by you know, law enforcement or immigration enforcement that are not uniformed or identified. And so understanding what your rights are and asserting those, even if they may be violated, is critical, because those can come back in your proceedings as well. And so understanding what you need in order to allow someone into your home, the aspects of what is a proper judicial warrant versus what ICE might show you as a warrant for an arrest and try to gain entry to your home. There's a lot going on nationwide in relation to searches and collateral arrests. We haven't yet seen that here in Alaska, but you know, it's something that could be coming down the pipeline. And so it's really important that non-citizens know their rights and can assert them if we do see these larger raids and enforcement actions that are occurring in other parts of the country.
Nick, follow up here. In an earlier interview, you said, yes, the law says you have to cross the border in a certain manner. But even when people cross without following a legal path, there is still due process. The U.S. Constitution covers everyone physically in this country.
Absolutely.
Talk about how that applies to non-citizens.
Well, just by doing exactly what Cindy just said, they have the rights to an attorney. They have the rights to, if somebody's going to go into their house, to have a search warrant, if they're going to be arrested. Now, the judicial and administrative warrants that we're talking about permit you to do different things. The administrative warrant that ICE issues does not let you go into a house, for example, versus the judicial warrant that would allow the officers to go in the house and search for either people or certain specific things that they're looking for.
So it doesn't matter if you're a non-citizen or a citizen, if there is not a judicial search warrant, it's not a legal order to enter your home.
Absolutely not. And I think the Trump administration is trying to blur that out and say that it doesn't apply to immigrants, and that is absolutely incorrect.
Cindy, the ACLU and Nick, your firm, Nations Law, is representing a UAA student who had his F1 visa canceled. Describe what happened and what the current standing is for him, for the student.
Yeah, so our plaintiff was one of thousands of students who, over the course of a month, had their F1s status terminated in an online program called CBIS because either they had any sort of interaction with law enforcement or their visa had been revoked. This happened over the course of a month around beginning in early May, March.
March 24th was the cutoff date.
Yeah, and so there were a number of cases that were brought by ACLU affiliates and for-profit firms as well, challenging these revocations. And what we've seen is that the administration has literally walked that back. They've reinstated, or they've said that they're going to reinstate all of the students whose statuses were terminated under that policy. And that happened in our case. Our client did have his status reinstated. Mm-hmm. Those proceedings are still ongoing. We're hoping we can reach an agreement with the government to further protect his rights and make sure that his status is not otherwise revoked without authority.
And how is he feeling about things? Does he feel like, okay, it's working, I'm okay?
I think there's still quite a bit of fear and uncertainty because of the erratic nature in which the government has been operating.
Yeah.
You know, they terminated all of these. Some of the information that's come out in other cases show that it was a 45-minute delay between a list of 600 students being sent to an official and him saying, yeah, terminate them all. And so it's really just this uncertain time. And there is this new policy that was created over the weekend in one of these cases. And there's just not a lot of trust in that policy or the processes in which the government is making these decisions.
We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers in Alaska, and what they need to know, and we all need to know, about the legal pathways for citizenship and staying in our country as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today, we're talking about immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers in our state. Our guests today are experts in this area. Issa Spatrisano is a refugee coordinator for Catholic Social Services here in Alaska. Nicholas Alano is an immigration attorney with Nations Law Group based in Anchorage. And Cindy Woods is the senior immigration law and policy fellow for the ACLU of Alaska. We had a email from Lena, who writes, can you talk about all immigrants, the ones that have been here waiting for years to get their status adjusted?
I know who that is from, actually.
And so, Nick, do you want to take that?
Absolutely. shout out to my friend Lena Mariscal out there from Sol de Medianoche. We as in the Hispanic community, the Latino community, have this conversation that that as our community of immigrants, we're not represented as much maybe in the refugee, because of what you were saying, there's no refugee program for Latin America. And so we're not really counted that much. And you don't see those numbers of how many people from Mexico or in Alaska, or how many Venezuelans. I can give you some numbers of people in removal proceedings, but they are not clear as to how many people we actually have here in a community. There's 40,000 Hispanics, Latinos in Alaska. I think that's about 9% of the population. 7% of that lives actually in Anchorage. We're pretty Anchorage-based. So there's a whole other page that is usually kind of that not under the light or the spotlight because they are not in the news. They're not in the refugees, or they're not just generally the ones that are at the reason or right at the border in that moment. So, yeah.
All right. Yes, I did want to ask you about people with legal status having trouble getting final documents. What's known about this? Is it a lack of staffing, or do you see it as a deliberate slowdown to prevent people from getting settled and into jobs and homes?
Yeah, the new administration inside of USCIS has put some programs on pause. And so we have Ukrainians who filed for re-parole, which they were legally allowed to do and did everything they should have done. They filed for their re-parole. They've been here for 2 years for humanitarian parole. They were told you can refile for additional time. They filed those sometimes 6 months in advance. And the administration in USCIS have paused and are not processing applications, which means the application is sitting somewhere in USCIS just waiting and waiting and waiting. In the meantime, this person's life has continued, of course. And legal documents that they need, like employment authorization documents, are expiring. And so we have Ukrainians losing their jobs, losing their rights to work because they did everything right they should have done. They filed very timely, and the administration isn't processing those applications. We're seeing something similar with adjustments of status, where there's a pause happening right now in adjustments of statuses for people who have refugee status, who have applied for an adjustment to lawful permanent resident. There's a pause. For refugees, it's good. They have the legal right to work. It continues. But for other populations, we have employers calling us and saying, I have this great employee that I really enjoy, that's doing great, that's doing all the right things. Can you tell me how I can help them? I'm like, yeah, call your representative in the federal government and tell them to tell USCIS to process their applications. And so I know we've worked with the federal, like the representatives like Markowski's office and others on this issue, who have tried to present ideas of at least process people's EAD so they can continue to work while they're here. And so I think there's this, again, disconnect that, well, if you don't have the documents you need, then you did something illegally. Well, that's not true. They did everything right. They haven't processed their applications.
Was there any reason given for why all of a sudden this pause has happened?
They're checking. They believe that fraud occurred in the program somewhere.
They're looking into the Biden.
They're looking into what they disagree with the Biden administration's approach. And so they're investigating fraud. And so everybody's on halt. And so this is real people's lives. These are your neighbors who can't work in jobs anymore.
All right. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Cheryl is in Anchorage. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello there.
Did you have a question?
I wanted to share a quick story. But I have a friend who is a labor and delivery nurse at Providence. And just last weekend, they had a 20-year-old in labor who didn't speak any English. And they could not get one translator on the phone to help with the delivery. And my friend said that they have noticed since ICE has already tried entering Providence Hospital and has entered it, that they're having trouble getting translators now to answer the phone when they're trying to help deliver babies to women who don't speak English. Mm. And they definitely are concerned about what's happening, and they definitely are relating the nurses there the people just being afraid now to do what they normally do because of the possibility of getting picked up.
All right, Cheryl, thank you for the call. Another example of some of those consequences that happen when things are so greatly disrupted. Nicholas, Issa was talking about, some of the unintended consequences of the risk of the current situation, and as it relates to people skipping appointments because they're afraid of being detained. Talk about some of what's happening there.
So what we've seen in Alaska recently is that people will show up to their adjustment that's getting their green card or their naturalization appointment, mostly for the adjustment, and or a visa interview, and they're actually picked up by ICE. So USCIS and ICE are working hand in hand. And USCIS will call ICE, for example, if a person had a previous deportation order from many years ago, they married a United States citizen, and now they are enforcing that order of removal before that, when that person shows up for that appointment. So that is something that is creating fear in people and that attorneys and other people that help out immigrants need to be aware of.
You also noted that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is limited here. What does that mean? How are they carrying out the work they're mandated to do? Are they? It seems like in some photos that I've seen from other parts of the country, it looks like there's sort of patches put on the backs of other law enforcement. So are they sort of deputizing local police department staff?
Yes. So it's not local. Let's differentiate between the federal police agencies and local APD and local state agencies. At a federal level, there is now an agreement. FBI has always worked with DHS. But now HSI is a subcomponent of ICE. And they're within the federal government. They're also working with other agencies like the DA. Those are the patches that you're seeing there. So you have a limited number of ICE agents here who are being supported by Homeland Security Investigations, who are being supported by CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, and who are being supported also by the FBI. Of pictures, we had two occasions. I've actually had the pleasure, let's call it that, of representing those individuals and in those cases. And the interesting thing is that most of those people are back in the community, and the pictures, in my opinion, were completely unwarranted.
We had a question from Doug in Anchorage, and I'm going to go to the second question that he has. He's got two questions here. His second question, I want to start with that one. Do you expect refugee status to be revoked from current Afghan refugees in Alaska given recent federal policy shifts?
I can speak to this. So it's in recent news. You may have seen that TPS for Afghans was revoked. And I think that
ends in July. Is that correct?
Yeah, it ends in July. And so I it's important to understand that most of the Afghans that arrived here to Alaska arrived on that humanitarian parole status. Nearly all of them have now adjusted their status to either LPR, lawful permanent resident, or have received asylum. So some of them completed the process that's called like a special immigrant visa. And so they are on that much more, we should call it steady ground, but I wouldn't call anything like safe at this point. They're on a more steady ground, right? And so these TPS rollbacks that we're seeing wouldn't affect them. We do have some Afghans who, for whatever reason, and it could just be delays in processing, USCIS doesn't often come to Alaska to do asylum interviews, as my colleagues know. They maybe come once a year or once every 6 years.
Yeah.
And so some of our cases have applications in and have not been able to adjust their status. And so there is concern for them because they are on this humanitarian parole program, though they do have applications pending. And so everything we knew about immigration law, 5 months ago would have said, yeah, they're on relatively steady ground, too, because they have these pending applications. So we're a little worried about those groups, and we've invested a lot of resources in ensuring they all have legal representation, they all have applications in. So we're kind of hoping that soon they'll be able to adjust to that more steady status, as an asylee or as a lawful permanent resident. So we don't have very many people here, I should say, for Afghans. It would be totally different for the administration to take back those statuses now, and that would immediately result in a law. I'd call my friends at ACLU quite quickly if that happened.
So the first part of Doug's question was one that I wasn't sure we would get to, but I was reading about the white South Africans, and Doug said, do you expect to receive Afrikaners from South Africa from the recent push by the Trump administration? The Guardian reported on the first arrivals this week in Washington, D.C. The Guardian wrote on February 7th, just 18 days after indefinitely closing United States borders to the world's refugees, Donald Trump announced one exception, Afrikaners, white South Africans descended predominantly from Dutch settlers, can now seek asylum in the U.S., while refugees fleeing war and persecution in places like Congo and Afghanistan will be turned away. Cindy, is this being challenged in court? White South Africans are welcome while others are not?
Not that I'm aware of, that the specific provision of allowing white South Africans through the refugee program. The indefinite closure of the refugee program has been litigated and challenged. And I think there was a decision just yesterday in that case that requires processing of over, Issa, you may know the number,
the
maybe
12,000.
Yeah, 12,000 for that process to continue. So the specific exception or addition of white Afrikaners has not been challenged, but the act of closing our doors to the rest of the world's refugees is actively being litigated in court.
And we know that there's dozens of court cases challenging the Trump administration's actions. What do you think will eventually shake out from all of these ongoing court proceedings? As you look at what's happening across the country, where do you think this lands?
I think we're seeing it already. I think it lands in the Trump administration having to walk back a lot of things, a lot of the decisions being enjoined or overturned. When I came into the administration, I was feeling a little bit hopeless as to our judiciary, and I think that they've stepped up, most of them. And I think that's where it's going to end. We're going to end up back with the Trump administration having to walk a lot of this back.
Cindy?
Yeah, I think we have our work cut out for us.
Oh, yeah.
Challenging the constitutionality of a lot of these cases, a lot of these new policies, we are seeing in many cases, you know, things being walked back. But we're also seeing in the case of Kilmar Brigo that we are at a constitutional impasse, and it's going to be really critical to see how the administration upholds these different court hearings. There's a number of questions that the administration is raising to the Supreme Court. And so we're going to have to see, you know, to what degree this administration respects the checks and balances that have been created in our founding documents, which, you know, it's a scary time.
It is.
Yeah.
We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on immigration, refugees, and asylum seekers in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Cindy, you had mentioned the call that we had earlier. Pick it up there about concern over ICE going into hospital settings.
Yeah, so it was one of the administration's first 100-day executive orders, basically revoking what was called the Sensitive Zones Memo, which for decades has provided protection from ICE enforcement around these protected areas such as schools, hospitals, churches, houses of worship. And the Trump administration revoked that memo so ICE could, you know, seek to enforce immigration laws in those sensitive areas. And I think part and parcel to that is, again, this idea of continuing to create a sense of fear in those communities. These are places where folks should not be afraid to go to seek essential services. However, now we're seeing that there is more increased fear of accessing those services in those areas. Recently, just this week, there's been a case that's challenging the rescission of those sensitive zones. We are also providing education across the community to organizations to let them know their responsibilities as well. Again, the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment applies to areas if there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in hospital rooms, in churches, in places that is not accessible to the public. You still need that properly executed judicial warrant to allow a search to occur. And so we're also seeking to continue to educate the community on how they can protect their neighbors, their clients, their constituents, and friends as well.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Alice is in Anchorage. Hello, Alice.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm in the medical field and a nurse, and the question I had is twofold. First, are the persons coming into Alaska or the United States, are they being screened medically? That's my expertise. I was just concerned about that. The reason I'm saying that is because I'm an immigrant myself, came as a 5-year-old years ago,
And I know that we had to have certain health screenings, x-rays, and so forth. And then the other question I have is, are they also being screened for their history, for any safety concerns here for the citizens, if criminal history or anything like that? And I also wanted just to add, I did hear the comment of the nurse that said that they could not get interpreters in the hospitals here. One of the ideas could be that the hospital or the clinics could contract with a company that has interpreters on call. They could put them, they could call them, or if they can, if they wanted to use Zoom or whatever, to facilitate the information that they wanted to give to the client, or just for education or whatever the questions they have. So they could do that route. Also, so one of the other things I wanted to say, since I do travel around as a nurse, I do go to California and so forth, and I do work in some buildings where they do process immigration and so forth. And I did come across a USCIS ICE person that came into the clinic. I had a concern of a rash that she had, and it was possibly some type of viral rash that she had. And she had been processing IDs, taking paperwork for these their clients that had already been had come across the border prior to the Trump administration. So what they were doing is they were having them check in with them. I don't know if it was monthly or so forth. But I don't know if they've even had any type of vetting as far as medically. So there is stuff going around, and it's just the safety concern medically, being in the medical field, and also safety for any criminal activities to protect us too as citizens.
All right. Thank you for the call, Alice. Is a follow-up there?
Yeah, I can speak to the refugee program specifically. Everybody is required to have a medical screening before arrival. They have all the public vaccinations that are recommended. They must have those when people are screened for TB. They're screened for public health concerns. There are things called, medical cases A and medical cases B. If we're aware of those cases, we're told in advance so we can work with medical providers here so we can make sure people are connected to healthcare in a very specific period of time. Ukrainians and others who came through those programs were required within a certain period of time of being here to get TB tested and complete those TB screenings and have vaccinations on record. When people go to do adjustment of statuses, they have to turn in vaccination records. So public health is a huge part of the immigration program. We work with the state public health teams here. We have a state refugee health coordinator whose entire job it is to ensure that those things are happening. They work with local health departments. And refugees are certainly heavily vetted. Department of Homeland Security, FBI, you name it, they are screened. Many people's backgrounds are, it's nice to meet you, come on in sort of program by any means. There's a lot of work that's done on both the medical side, especially public health. I always say refugee health screenings are not actually about a refugee's health. They're actually about our health as Americans.
Certainly.
They actually don't see a doctor for their health until they get here. Really, all the overseas screening is really about public health, our health as a community.
And that health screening goes way back. I visited Ellis Island to find my grandfather's name when he came through there. And, and there's all kinds of records there about what kind of intensive health screening they did. And people got sent back if there was anything, if they had an infection or anything. People were just sent away. We had an email from Rich in Juneau saying, in some videos of ICE activities, there appear to be law enforcement individuals involved, military, he says, or Proud Boy type persons, heavily armed and masks. He's wondering if ICE is legally deputizing other folks.
I'm going to jump in and say no.
Okay.
When people outside the government are not being deputized here. They are from sister agencies. We already went over those. There is an ability for the federal government to partner up with cities and local law enforcement, usually something that's called a 237G agreement. We actually have one in Alaska for the Department of Corrections. And what they do is issue a detainer. ICE issues a detainer if somebody comes in that has a questionable, for them, immigration status. But what the person is probably referring to is the garb that is being utilized in the raids and the detentions. It's and I've seen this before. I saw this in 2010, like very heavily armed, long firearms to pick up people by immigration. Let's look at this from the flip side. We do have individuals that are serious criminals who happen to be immigrants. And when you are going to pick up somebody like that, you also have to take those measures. You do also have to use discretion. Know that if you're going to pick up a mom or a family, you don't need to go in like that.
The Trump administration likes to use language that says we're being invaded. This is an emergency. That's why we've seen these executive orders. In challenges in courts, are judges asking or demanding for some sort of documentation or evidence that denotes an invasion to when the government is making their case?
The Trump administration's use of this rhetoric around invasion is completely politically charged. And I think we've seen that come up multiple times in the various cases that are challenging the use of the Alien Enemies Act that is the basis for these removals of Venezuelans who are suspected of being part of the Tren de Aragua gang to CECOT in El Salvador. And so the ACLU affiliates and National have brought challenges in multiple jurisdictions, and we've seen courts in various parts of Texas and New York and other places as well that have all come down and said that this is unlawful to invoke this idea of invasion specifically to a subset of individuals, not a country. And so we're concerned that this language is continuing to be used potentially with this idea of suspending habeas corpus and other things, like continuing to frame it as an invasion so that the government can utilize really old laws that have only been invoked in actual times of war in very limited circumstances.
And because we only have about a minute left, talk about the potential for suspending habeas corpus and how that could affect not just people who are in the country from other places.
Really fast, I just want to add to that.
Yes.
Actually, I think we had a Trump-appointed judge in Texas. I might be wrong with this, but he actually said that the Alien Enemies Act does not apply here because we are not under invasion. So I think that going back to maybe we're seeing some light from the judiciary. I don't know if you want to jump into the habeas corpus there, Cindy.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fundamental right that has been inscribed in our founding documents that has very rarely been invoked in only three instances in our history during the Civil War, briefly in Hawaii during World War II, and I think in 1905 in the Philippines. It's only a power that Congress can utilize. And so I think there has already been a lot of outcry from our elected representatives and from others just at this idea that they're floating, that habeas could be suspended.
And for folks who are unfamiliar with that legal term, what does it mean?
Habeas allows an individual to challenge their detention and protect against executive overreach by having their detention, the evidence, be presented to them and the ability to defend that in court.
All right. Thank you so much to my guest today, Isis Batrisano, the Refugee Coordinator for Catholic Social Services, Nicholas Olano, Immigration Attorney with Nations Law Group, and Cindy Woods, Senior Immigration Law and Policy Fellow with the ACLU of Alaska. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor, Annie Feit, and on the phones, Hannah Floor helped us out today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.